Welcome to Open Spaces. Willow Belden is away. I'm Bob Beck. One of the issues confronting Governor Matt Mead is whether or not the state should expand Medicaid services to more residents. The argument for doing it is that it would help bring down long-term costs of health care because those who cannot get or afford insurance would be covered under Medicaid. That should reduce cost shifting. But there is an expense to the state, and a recent study commissioned for the Department of Health suggested that it could actually cost Wyoming millions over a six-year period. Governor Matt Mead joins us to describe why he's concerned.
I'm looking at some numbers that the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities put out, and just essentially saying that their thought is there's about 31,000 uninsured adults who'd be eligible for Medicaid if this is expanded, and 24,000 would be newly eligible for Medicaid. Does that sound right to you? Is that kind of the numbers you're looking at?
Numbers we're looking at, that's close to what the recent study came out. I think their best estimate is that they practically think about 26,000, I think it is. Their high end is about 44,000. And so those numbers that you're citing are pretty consistent with the Milliman study.
There are some people that might be getting insurance right now that probably would drop into Medicaid. Is that correct?
There's a couple of categories. There is, and these the terms that I use are the terms that are sort of the industry terms. And so, people need to understand where these come from. One is what they call, there's a group that may be called the deliberately poor. In other words, they're sort of on that borderline, and it makes better economic sense for them to not have quite as much income to get off of private insurance and then get onto Medicaid. And the Milliman study calculates how many of those folks who are currently not on Medicaid would be on Medicaid. The other thing that they calculate, which is I think of greater concern, is some employers, in particular small employers, as they look at it, and particularly if they have some lower paid employees, they may do away with their group health insurance plan at a company and have people get on Medicaid. And so some of that is, it's a direction from private insurance and sort of a deliberate goal to get down to Medicaid because, as you know, it's the federal poverty limit up to 133%, but the actual number is 138% because they add 5% sort of flex in there. So anybody that's on that border, they'll be making decisions, and employers will be making decisions whether to drop some of those people. On top of that, there is what they call the Woodwork population, which is the population that is currently eligible for Medicaid now, but for whatever reason has chosen not to enroll. That will be an increase too. But those people, don't believe are currently on any insurance, so that wouldn't move from private insurance to Medicaid. So when we look at some of the studies, people are anticipating the cost of private insurance will go up as a result of the expansion and the full ACA implementation.
Do you think really, have you had any indication from businesses in the state that they would dump people into Medicaid or into some system? And the only reason I'm challenging that, Governor, when I've interviewed a number of employers in the state, and I certainly haven't talked to everybody, it hasn't sounded like that would necessarily be everyone's strategy. I'm curious if you're hearing something different.
I have not had any employer come and say, hey, when it's implemented, this is we're going to drop our employees from insurance and we're going to let them get on Medicaid. That sort of phenomenon comes from the Milliman study, who says that can happen, and they're suggesting that their rough estimate is that X amount of people and X amount of employers may do that.
There are some people that you're going to have to cover. Your study indicated that would probably cost the state about $33 million. How much more if you actually decided to expand Medicaid, as far as your numbers say?
The full ACA expansion suggests that the state share in that 2014 to 2020 is from $53 million to $310 million. So, that's a very large range, obviously, and that's in part because they make clear in there, depending upon which assumptions they make turn out to be accurate, that is the range. Now, having said that, they also point out that, we currently have some programs in the state that with the Medicaid expansion, those programs that we currently have may save some money because it's going to move people from those programs over to Medicaid. And with 100% reimbursement for the first several years by the federal government, there'll be a possible savings in some of those programs. On the flip side of that, they point out when you put a lot more people into healthcare, you may have an initial spike because you're going to be seeing some people who have delayed seeing physicians and nurses for some period of time who may have some serious health problems that need to be addressed. And so how all that balances out and the net of that is difficult to determine. And I think that's why you see a range from 53 to, you know, $310 million on the state share.
Is there any thinking, though, if you're getting people into a system where they're having some sort of insurance, like a Medicaid, that actually those costs would eventually gradually go down because they're finally getting coverage, which eventually would lead to prevention and maybe save some costs down the line?
I mean, I think that certainly is the hope, that if you get more people in a program, that they will work more on the wellness side rather than the fix my illness side. And I don't think that's an unreasonable hope. However, I would point out, you know, as you look statewide, emergency room visits of per year for people on private insurance versus people on Medicaid, and the people on Medicaid visit emergency rooms considerably more than people on private insurance. Now, that's a number, and like I said, you got to be a little careful with that because it may be a reflection that the people on Medicaid are not as healthy, but it's also a suggestion that people on Medicaid are not as conscious about some of the considerations of people on private insurance. But all those are broad brushes, and so the hope that you get more people on health insurance, certainly there's a hope that we will, as a population, become healthier, but whether that plays out or not, I don't know.
It sounds to me like you're leaning against the expansion. Is that fair?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I'm leaning against it in this sense, that I think that it's appropriate for me to ask questions of HHS on how the expansion is going to work, how health insurance exchange is going to work, and to get answers to those questions. And, you know, I wrote to the secretary in July and have not received answers. This is a big question on Medicaid expansion, and I'm going to continue to meet with healthcare providers, insurance folks, patients, because what I don't want it to be, to me, it shouldn't be just sort of a political reaction of, hey, I didn't like the Affordable Care Act, and so now I'm not going to participate. You know, the fact is the Supreme Court's made its decision, and it's currently the law of the land. But it's not an easy decision for me, and the reason I'm sort of leaning against it now is because I think we're deserving some answers before we commit the state of Wyoming to the increased costs, before we need answers to see whether or not this is actually going to provide better health care in the state of Wyoming. I mean, the goal is we want better health care for more of our citizens, and to do it as reasonably as we can in terms of costs. And it is very complex. There's a lot of moving targets. And if you read the Milliman study, you can see there is so many variables. So I would say if I have to vote today of yes, no, or undecided, I'm still in the undecided category. But I'm becoming increasingly frustrated that we as a state cannot get some of our questions answered on how this is all going to work.
Governor Matt Mead, as always, thank you very much for your time. Staying with the topic of health care, an ambulance staffed with a team of experienced first responders can make a world of difference in an emergency. This is especially true in rural Wyoming, where the hospital can be an hour away or more. What many people don't realize is that most of Wyoming's emergency medical services, or EMS workers, are volunteers, and their numbers are dwindling. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez filed this report.
Guard Ferguson has been a first responder in Washakie County for 2 decades. The Worland resident remembers his first call before officially joining any force. His mother-in-law was an emergency medical technician for the ambulance service in Tent Sleep and invited him to help respond to a call at Meadowlark Lake in the middle of the night. A man there was in cardiac arrest.
I went up and helped and did CPR on a gentleman for 3 hours. Yeah, it's a long way from the top of the mountain to the hospital, so.
Now Ferguson is the assistant ambulance director for Washakie County. He's a volunteer EMT in Worland and has to keep the town's ambulance with him half the time, ready at any moment to respond to a call. He is also the ambulance director for the 10 Sleep Ambulance Service 30 miles away.
Some people, they call it a trauma junkie, you know.
Ferguson says the 10 Sleep EMS crew has 10 volunteers and Worland has 20, give or take. He says they're all compassionate people who work around their day jobs to help their neighbors. They respond to senior citizens who've fallen and can't get up. They care for diabetic patients or people suffering heart attacks on the way to the nearby hospital. They hike into remote mountain areas near 10 Sleep to rescue victims of rock climbing falls and hunting accidents. And it's all handled with carefully regulated medical professionalism.
We can't talk about what we do, though, because of the HIPAA violations and things like that. So people don't know what we do.
But professionals in the state are saying it's time more people knew about the work EMS volunteers do and to support them before communities lose them. As baby boomers age and Wyomingites live longer, EMS professionals have more work on their hands. The Wyoming Department of Healthcare says that state EMS personnel have seen a 28% increase in emergency calls over the last 6 years. State EMS Administrator Andy Genap says when EMS jobs became common in the 1970s, their main responsibility was to transport patients to the hospital. Genap says a lot has changed since then.
At all the levels of providers, EMT or intermediate or paramedic, we expect them to take interventions and provide appropriate treatment for the patient that they find. And in some areas, that care becomes very complex, and we do expect them to make judgments based on their training and their level of expertise.
Genap points out that 20% of Wyoming's EMS professionals are unpaid volunteers who maintain jobs outside their demanding rescue work. For the last few years, the Wyoming legislature has approved funding to help reimburse EMT instructors. Genap says it comes out to about $4 an hour, but the number of volunteers isn't increasing to meet demand. In fact, EMT training and testing class sizes have shrunk in some parts of the state. Many attribute it to time constraints balancing work, family, and longer EMS training classes. Emergency health care is even more difficult in a place like Bags, where their local health care center closed suddenly in March. Bags Mayor Kathy Stamen says senior citizens no longer have a place where they can get regular checkups and treatment, and it's difficult for them to get to the nearest hospitals.
The emergency medical services in Bags has been a huge part of Bags because we are so remote. We're about 38 miles from Craig, Colorado, and 76 miles from Rawlins, Wyoming.
The burden now falls on the Little Snake River Rural Health District to address these issues and emergencies. Although the district has levied taxes to reimburse the EMS volunteers, it's not much. Volunteers are offered about $3 per hour if they're on call and $45 per ambulance run. Longtime EMT Sue Lee says it's not enough to lure more volunteers.
We're not doing it for the money, and even if we weren't getting paid, that's not why we do it. We do it to, you know, help the people and respond when we can.
Lee says the EMS work in the area is stressful because they respond to serious traffic crashes and accidents in nearby oil fields, and without a local clinic, calls take longer because they have to transport patients even further. Plus, the EMTs still have to work around families and full-time jobs. She says the volunteer EMS model is a thing of the past in Bags and worries that the number of certified EMTs in the area will fizzle out without a real wage.
I don't ever want to quit the EMS because of not enough EMTs, but it's also called burnout. And when you only have 3 or 4 EMTs that are constantly responding, you're just exhausted from trying to be on every single call and trying to be around for everything. And there's just times when you can't.
State EMS Administrator Andy Genap says many rural areas in the state simply can't afford full-time EMTs, especially if they rely on patient fees for transport to cover wages and equipment. Instead, he thinks more localities, residents, and legislators need to work together to strengthen support for EMS volunteers around the state. Genap's office is looking at solutions to the problem. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
Coming up, we'll learn about the history of state parks in Wyoming and what they're doing now. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. This is the 75th year of state parks in Wyoming. Dominic Bravo oversees state parks, historic sites and trails, and he says state parks have an interesting history.
Technically, if you look at Hot Springs State Park, it was actually a state reserve in the 1800s. So a lot of our historic sites are even longer than 75 years, but it wasn't until 1937 when the then governor, Leslie, had put together a state park commission. So it actually was to be able to look at putting this into a system where we were actually a system of state parks, and then the historic sites and then the trails program all came after that. So it was really just a phenomenal time for us and really visionary on the part of the state of Wyoming and all the leaders at the time to be able to put that system in place and really kind of represent some of the greatest things we have in the state of Wyoming.
Well, I certainly am aware of issues involving state parks, historic sites, and trails, and one of the biggest thing is certainly money these days. We're all talking about budget cuts, but how have you maintained, how are you surviving, and what's the future kind of look like there?
Our biggest issue, again, is as we see it, is we're really a key component for tourism in the state. So no matter what goes on, we're going to continue to try to figure out, you know, through partnerships, to try to find alternative funding, of course, our corporate relationships, anything we can to make sure we're doing our best job and putting our foot forward to serving the customers and the visitors. So that's really how we're trying to accomplish that, is still to meet our mission. Not so that it's not easy. We're definitely trying to struggle through some of these hard, difficult economic times ever since 2008. But at the same time, I mean, our ultimate goal is we enjoy seeing the smiling faces of families and folks, you know, out enjoying the parks and the sites and getting out on the trail. So our goal at the end of the day is to figure out the best way we can get all those services in place.
How big of a challenge is this issue dealing with the paid portion of state parks and knowing that a lot of people want their outdoors for free?
It's a very interesting phenomenon for the mere fact, again, like you said, it's the public trust. So being able to have these and protect these areas and make sure they're open to public access. But again, that balance, especially regionally, and just as a visitation mechanism to make sure the user fees kind of comport with that. In 2008, we increased our fees to kind of match regionally all the different states around, and really that kind of has put us at a level where at this point, really charging too much more is going to be difficult. However, it's been great for us because with the additional fees, we've been able to put a lot of new amenities that our visitors have asked for, like shower houses and yurts and cabins and electrical hookups, while still maintaining that balance with some of the more kind of native and non-commercial campsites. So we've really tried to kind of strike that balance with the increase in user fees. But it is a difficult thing. You have to increase fees pretty high to be able to actually make something self-sustaining.
You just recently mentioned a little bit about what's been happening in the state, how you've been trying to upgrade some of the state parks. Would you talk about that? I'm very familiar with what you're doing here at Kirk Gowdy, but maybe other folks in the state aren't. And maybe you could talk about some of the upgrades we've done in other places around the state as well.
For instance, at Guernsey, Guernsey State Park, we've experimented with a whole bunch of different amenities. They have electrical hookups and water at portions of their campsites. They have four yurts that luckily weren't damaged by the fire they recently had. They just had a new shower house they got put in this summer. So they pretty much have most of any amenity you can think of up at Guernsey State Park. Glendoe, much like the success of Kirk Gowdy Trails we have up at Glendoe, we've been able to put into place some additional miles of non-motorized trails that are, again, getting some regional visitation. And again, increasing the visitation in a new way at Glendoe State Park. Buffalo Bill has up there close to Cody has received some hookup sites as well, you know, water and electric, and they're slated to also be getting a shower house here fairly quickly. Of course, the big education center or visitor center going in at Kirk Gowdy State Park that'll be built by next year. That's slated to have showers in the basement of that facility and pretty much kind of a wonderful way to welcome folks to the park up here. folks really all around. And then in the Trails program, we've upgraded to some of the ways that we can provide snowmobile miles, groomed miles to folks, and some of the ORV grant programs. We've been able to put some more money on the ground for ORVs across the state. So really just across the board, doing our best to get money to the ground for visitors to come and enjoy and then improve the economic impact for local communities.
Dominic Bravo, he is the administrator of State Parks, Historic Sites, and Trails. Always nice chatting with you, Dominic, and thank you for joining us on Open Spaces.
It's great. I appreciate it, Bob. Thank you.
Now we turn our attention to the arts. The University of Wyoming Symphony opens its season next week. The director, Michael Griffith, joins me now. Michael, I think the place to start is just to kind of talk about your experience. You were in China, Finland. You've been a lot of places recently, and so you come up with this theme, Beyond Borders. Are you going to be bringing some of those experiences to the stage here?
I think so. As a matter of fact, that was sort of the genesis behind this whole idea. For the folks that might not have read this, I taught for a week at the Sibelius Academy, which is in Helsinki, Finland. And then I just kept on flying east, and I was in Shanghai for a month as part of the UW Shanghai University Exchange Professorship. And while I was in Shanghai, they also had me working with a youth orchestra in town, with a community orchestra in town, a lot of things beyond the campus. And at one point, I was standing in this rehearsal hall, which was actually on the 10th floor of a big building in downtown Shanghai. And before the rehearsal started, I was staring out the window, and there was this incredible traffic. And the architecture of Shanghai is really striking, not just that which is traditional Chinese, but they have some very, very interesting modern architecture. And then the billboards, of course, which were very bright and very, very eye-catching and in Chinese. And I felt so out of place. This was not my life in Laramie. And then I turned and walked into the hall, and people were taking instruments out of the case, and they were warming up, and they were chatting, and they were practicing their parts, and they were tuning. And all of a sudden, I felt, oh, I'm at home again. Music is music is music. And that sort of led me to some ideas for programming for the year and for guests for the year. Actually, my contacts at Shanghai mean that the Shanghai University Orchestra will be in Laramie on our October 4th concert joining us, that we will be doing some Chinese folk music. And also, just over the course of the year, as we look at borders, I'm going to do some music that is very much geographically specific. Our first big orchestra concert, we're doing the George Gershwin Piano Concerto. If that couldn't be the quintessential American piece, I don't know what is. It's jazzy, it's flashy, and yet it's definitely classical music. We're doing some Chinese folk music on that same concert. The next concert, we're doing a piece by Vaughan Williams, who's an English composer, and he even names it a London Symphony. And you will hear the Big Ben chimes as part of it. In our last concert of the year, we're actually doing the Verdi opera La Traviata. Well, most people know Verdi as a great Italian composer, but he was more than that. At the time that Verdi was living, most of Italy was not actually an independent country, but it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And Verdi became the symbol for the nationalist movement. It'll be different from perhaps Beethoven, Brahms, which is sort of standard middle-of-the-road classical music. And so you'll enjoy and appreciate those differences and yet be able to get it. And it's not just borders geographic. The very first thing the orchestra is doing, we're going to do the entire Vivaldi Four Seasons. We're actually going to do it right on the autumnal solstice, September 22nd. So instead of starting with spring like the Four Seasons are usually done, we'll start with autumn. Well, that is going to use a total of about 15 people on the stage. That's not symphony orchestra stuff. That's not even chamber orchestra stuff. That is Baroque orchestra stuff. Why do we have to say symphony orchestra always has to use everybody? When we played La Traviata, we are accompanying the entire concert. It's an opera orchestra. Why do we have to have these kinds of borders also? So the idea is let's open our minds. Let's hear lots of different kinds of music that may be geographically appropriate for different parts of the world, that may be for different kinds of music. But nevertheless, they can be played by a symphony orchestra and enjoyed tremendously.
Kick things off on the 22nd, as you said.
With the entire Vivaldi Four Seasons.
It should be great. Now, how do folks find out about all of your schedules and all that's going on this year?
The one phone number that will get you anything you want is 766-6666. You can call them to order tickets. You can call them and they will mail you a brochure. They will sell you season tickets, which, of course, are a great bargain. So that's 766-6666. tickets, brochure will be sent to you. Or if you just Google University of Wyoming Symphony Orchestra, that'll take you to our homepage, and then there's a link. You can actually look at the season brochure right on the homepage that way.
See where the guest artists are going to be and all that kind of
see
thing.
See everything, including this really pretty picture on our brochure of a globe surrounded by music notes with the UW Symphony logo right in the middle.
Michael Griffith, always nice having you back. Good luck with the season, and thank you for joining us. We'll talk more in the future.
Thank you, Bob.
When we come back, we'll have a story on how Cheyenne is addressing its homeless population, and Laramie is pushing for a technology park. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. More than 1 million acres of forest in Wyoming and Colorado has been impacted by the beetle kill epidemic. That means lots of dry fuel for forest fires, but it also may have an impact on wildlife. So the Wyoming Game and Fish Department is conducting a study to figure out how beetle kill is affecting elk and elk hunters. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden spoke with wildlife biologist Tony Mong, who's heading the study. He says the worry is that dead trees could be restricting access to certain parts of the forest.
When the trees die, they eventually fall over. And when they fall over, they become very difficult to traverse. And so what we want to look at is, are hunters able to access areas where elk are accessing, as well as look at how elk are using the forest and if that changes because of this beetle downfall.
So how are you carrying out this study? I mean, if we're just starting this now, obviously beetle kill is in full swing already. So did you have sort of a baseline study that you're now comparing things to?
So with beetle kill, the way it progresses is that once initially the tree is infected with these beetles, usually takes 7 to 10 years before the trees actually begin to fall. We're right at that kind of cusp of things starting to change. So I think that we'll be able to get some baseline information as well as continue it through the progression of this beetle downfall and see how those things change and if they change.
And then you're doing this with GPS monitoring.
That's correct. So we're using GPS technology for both the elk, and we're going to be using that for the hunters. Back in February of 2012, this year, we collared 26 cow elk on the winter range of the elk that use the Sierra Madre forest, and we've been following them ever since. And so we're going to follow this up with actually asking for help from the public, from hunters, to carry GPS units with them during their hunts in the Sierra Madre forest.
And so then you'll be able to see where the elk go and where the hunters go.
Exactly. And so what we'll be able to ultimately get is that interaction, one of where the elk are, where the hunters are. Are the hunters able to get to the elk? And then if there are spots where hunters aren't accessing, is that caused from beetle downfall?
How do you figure it out, whether a hunter is not going to an area because of beetle killer, because of something else?
So we get to, in my job, play with a lot of fancy software, and one of those is called a geographic information system. And so what we're able to do is take these areas from aerial photos and look at where the beetle kill is. We put that onto a map, and then we also map the movements of these hunters and also the elk. And then we can begin to see spatially if there's any correlation to where these hunters aren't using or where the elk are not going. So,
what do you expect to find here?
That's a tough question to answer. There are so many different hypotheses that we have on what could be occurring out there. Talking with hunters last year and over the last couple years, it seems like they are running into areas that are really difficult for them to access. And so I would expect to see that some of the areas of the forest are going to become unusable. And that's a concern for game and fish, and it should be for I think most of the public, because this is the way that we manage populations is through hunter harvest. And if the hunters are not able to access the forest and harvest the animals that are needed, we're going to get an overpopulation of elk. If we have an overpopulation of elk, then we need to start worrying about disease issues and also food issues on the ground for other species, other cattle, and other wildlife as well.
So what can be done about this? I mean, let's say you find that, yes, there are certain areas where hunters aren't able to access the elk, and then they're harvesting fewer elk. What can you do about that?
What we hope to do is work really close with the Forest Service as they start to implement management plans. And so if we can designate some areas where it's really difficult to get into, maybe we can start to harvest some of the trees out of there. Maybe we can start to clear some of those trees out of there and really look at using this as a management tool for the forest as well as for the game and fish.
And of course, you touched on this already a bit, but just to kind of recap, why is it so important to know how beetle kill is affecting hunters and elk?
So, yeah, I did touch on how, as far as managing the herd and specifically how hunters access the forest. But in addition to that, if we think about an animal that finds it difficult to get through an area, they're going to start to reroute those traditional migration routes and how they use the forest. If that occurs, we could start to see less use on the forest, more use off the forest. And generally off the forest, we've got a bit more private ground, a little bit more grazing going on there. And so those concerns of if there's enough food on the ground becomes even more prominent in those situations.
And so in that scenario, you might see elk competing with livestock more.
You could. That there is that potential. If the forest becomes impassable for them, they may stay on the edge a little bit more. And so we really need to kind of understand how they're going to change their use.
So if hunters would like to get involved with this study, what should they do?
They should go hunting just as normal. We will be contacting folks out in the field. One thing we don't want to happen is hunters to plan a hunting trip that is different than their normal hunting trip. A lot of people would probably take this as a competition maybe and say, how far can I walk in a day? So we're going to be contacting people in the field at their hunting camps and also as they come out to hunt and ask them to carry these GPS units.
All right. Well, Tony Mong with the Game and Fish Department, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Cheyenne Police Department has launched an initiative that's meant to help the homeless get access to shelter and other services and to keep them out of jail. The cops in one shelter in town are optimistic about the program, but various advocacy groups have major concerns. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden has that story.
The initiative got started because of frustration with homeless people breaking the law. Business owners in downtown Cheyenne complained of people panhandling, drinking in public, urinating on the street, and trying to sleep in their businesses. Police Chief Brian Kozak says repeated arrests became the norm.
A lot of people are getting jail sentences a day here, 2 days there, repeatedly. Someone might be in the court five times, and each time they get a day in jail.
Kozak says all that jail time is costing the city a lot of money. So last month, the police department created the Homeless Empowerment Action Team, or HEAT. The team consists of a few police officers and Robin Zimmer, the director of Cheyenne's homeless shelter, the Kamiya House. Together, they go around town and talk with homeless people.
We explain what the rules are in the city. For example, panhandling, it's a state law that you cannot ask a passing car for money. You can't camp in the city parks overnight, can't be drunk in public, and you can't drink in public either. And those are laws that if you do break, you'll be arrested.
Kozak says they also tell people about the resources available to them, about the Kamiya shelter, about help they can get with substance abuse problems, about medical services in the community. Kozak says the goal is to help homeless individuals who have caused problems become law-abiding citizens.
You know, we're here to help you, but if you choose to continue to break the law, the consequences, of course, go up.
If people don't agree to seek help and continue to break the law, they could now face 30 days in jail rather than just one or two. I joined the Heat team on a recent outing. As we drove through the Walmart parking lot, Robin Zimmer from the Kamiya House and Officer Dan Long spotted a young woman with two dogs sitting on a curb. She had dreadlocks, a lip ring, and pants that had been patched many times over. A young man soon joined her. Their dogs lapped up water from a dented tin bowl as we approached.
Hey, we're just going around talking to everyone about the this new program we have. It's called the Homeless Empowerment Action Team, Operation Heat.
Oh, yeah?
And have you heard of the Kamiya Shelter?
Thank you. I have dogs at the Kamiya Shelter. But have you guys been through there for food boxes and stuff?
No. Oh, we haven't been here long.
The homeless woman said she needed medical care, and Zimmer promised to take her to the emergency room. But the Heat team was at a loss for where the couple could stay for the night with their dogs. That dilemma highlights problems that critics see with Operation Heat. They argue that telling people there are plenty of resources available is misleading because the resources aren't available to everyone. You cannot stay at the shelter if you have pets, and you also can't stay there if you've been drinking. Kamiya does a breathalyzer on everyone. And then there's another problem. As Linda Burt with the ACLU points out, shelter space is limited.
We have about 500 homeless people in Cheyenne, and we have about 75 beds.
Burt says that leaves homeless people with two options: break the law by camping out on city property or leave town. And she says forcing them to make that choice is wrong. So far, most people have chosen the first option, stay on the streets. Police Chief Brian Kozak says the majority of the individuals they've talked to have declined offers for assistance.
They do not want help. They want to be on the street.
Neil Donovan with the National Coalition for the Homeless says that's a clue that the HEAT program might be misguided.
I don't believe that these people are saying that they don't want help. What they're saying is that how you define help and the resources that you attach to that help is not the type of help that they want or need.
Donovan says people may have had traumatic experiences at shelters elsewhere and may simply be too scared to go to Kamiya.
If you are psychotic, if you are clinically depressed, if you have been raped or stabbed or assaulted in a shelter, the likelihood that you want to subject yourself to that is remote. So when somebody says you need to get off the street and go into a shelter, then that really is not guidance that the person can accept.
Donovan adds that having a shelter that's only available to people who are sober won't get alcoholics off the street. Robin Zimmer with Kamiya says those are legitimate concerns. She's hoping to develop an additional housing unit where there would be no questions asked and no breathalyzers administered, where people would have their own private rooms to feel safer. Until she gets the money for the project, Zimmer is adding beds to the Kamiya House. She's optimistic that through the HEAT program, she'll be able to make inroads with the homeless community. She says sometimes inviting people to a shelter and offering to help them find work rather than waiting for them to come on their own can make all the difference.
I really don't know how many more people we're going to find or whether they'll come to us for help, but I feel better knowing that we've connected with them.
The police department plans to assess the HEAT program at the end of the year and decide whether or not to continue it. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
The city of Laramie has not been famous for its economic development success. Laramie has seen a growth in technology jobs, but did not have the infrastructure to attract at least two large mega data centers. In an effort to change that, city leaders are going all out to purchase property and develop what will initially be a 160-acre technology park. The chair of the Laramie Economic Development Corporation's Board of Directors is Megan Getz. She says the idea to develop the park came from missed opportunities.
It's from a series and years of data and saying, why have we missed these projects? Why have the companies chosen to locate in Cheyenne? Why have the companies not chosen Laramie? And we're talking big companies.
So the Economic Development Group commissioned a report and got some answers.
The bottom line was we don't have shovel-ready turnkey sites that are available and attractive to data centers and green technology businesses.
The plan is this. Laramie wants to acquire a
grant of more than $5 million from the Wyoming Business Council's Community Readiness Program to purchase land north of the community near a power substation to develop what they're calling the Sirisky Technology Park. It intends to set up infrastructure to attract tech companies and data centers to town. University of Wyoming officials say that Laramie has about 60 technology-based businesses, and some of them came from the Wyoming Technology Business Center. That's a high-tech business incubator near campus. Getz says they conducted a survey and received some positive results.
Projection is that we will create 165 jobs in the next 5 years in the tech center. And so it's a matter of finding places for the existing businesses that are already here to expand and stay and also recruit the new.
Along those lines, University of Wyoming Vice President for Research Bill Gurn says UW plans to purchase some of that property from the city to develop a research park that can be a place for technology companies to go when they leave the incubator and to attract similar companies. Gurn is very optimistic about Laramie's effort.
We're having small technology companies coming to us from other locations saying, we're getting awfully interested in southeastern Wyoming. We like the business climate that we see that Wyoming has created. We want to be closer to the university because the university has a reputation for supporting these kinds of businesses.
The Laramie City Council has agreed to set aside $500,000 to be used as a match to leverage the Wyoming Business Council grant. City Manager Janine Jordan says they are fully on board.
I think the council absolutely saw the vision and realized that there was a carpe diem opportunity here to seize the moment. And to draw in those kind of data center or technology clients.
Jordan admits she's very excited about what growing the technology center could mean for Laramie.
I think this could be a game changer for the community.
The proposed property is located on a ridge above Laramie. It's a flat piece of ag land with nothing on it except a power substation. A bunch of new homes have been built nearby. Some area residents, though, have expressed concern about the size and scope of the project and the fact that some of the facilities would be too close to homes. Nearby resident Shane Murphy says they'd only be a short distance away, which is unacceptable.
The property they're proposing to buy only goes from 100 feet back to a couple acres back. They have a development proposal for this whole huge area that goes way back north on the ridge. But that's not what they're proposing to buy. They're proposing to buy an area that is directly adjacent to neighborhood homes.
Murphy says there is a much better way to go.
To me, this proposal would be so much better if they took the whole parcel of land they're proposing to buy, made that a setback, made that a green space that people could enjoy, and then developed beyond there.
City and economic development officials say the area will be more like a campus with trails incorporated into the plan, and they say they're trying to address resident concerns. But Murphy says communication has been lacking. He and others also note there are other vacant structures that could be used for economic development purposes in the community right now. But Gay Stockman, who heads up Laramie's Economic Development Corporation, says those structures are not adequate. Stockman calls this an important moment.
We really need to diversify our income for the county, and providing opportunities for capital improvements, property taxes, sales tax, things like that is significant for our future.
The Business Council will consider Laramie's grant application in December, and the State Loan and Investment Board will have the final say after that. When we come back, we'll wrap up our program with a story about Cowboy Joe. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. With the start of the football season comes the start of Cowboy Joe's work season. Cowboy Joe, if you don't know, is one of two University of Wyoming mascots. He's a pony with a lot of attitude, who arguably has more admirers than some of the football players themselves. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhoroff reports that the current mascot is actually Cowboy Joe 4, and he's passing the reins to Cowboy Joe 5.
Cowboy Joe is University of Wyoming's live Shetland pony mascot. He has four handlers to care for him and fawn over him. The lead handler is Kendra Winslow, who affectionately calls him Joseph. She prepared him for work on the morning of UW's first home football game.
If you'd hold still, he'd look nicer.
Goodness gracious. Come on. Joseph.
In actuality, there are currently two ponies, and the handlers took them both, Cowboy Joe 4 and 5, over to the stadium. Joe 4 started in 1992 and will retire mid-season because, says Winslow, he's getting a little hard to handle.
Can you feel it? Does he pull in on you guys pretty hard?
Yeah.
He just gets so excited. He knows this is his job, and he gets so excited. And then that's half the problem, but he really likes it.
The pony runs out on the field after every touchdown. Last year, he pulled Winslow along on her stomach during the first game as he rushed out to do his victory lap. This year, he did the same to another handler before the game even started. Number 5 is still in training, so for the next few games, fans will have the pleasure of admiring two ponies in Tailgate Park.
Oh, it's getting sniffy.
One of the admirers happened to be Brian Hines from Torrington.
I did this in 1951.
He was a handler for the original Cowboy Joe, Joe 1.
We traveled all over the state. We went in the bars everywhere, you know, ahead of homecoming. We did a tour, and everyone said, bring him in, bring him in. So we just beat him right into the bars and have a drink. If he pooped on the floor, he just pooped on the floor.
Hines turned to look at Joe 5.
What are you calling him?
Joe.
Okay.
That's
great. That's great. Can he run as hard as fast as the first one?
None of the Joes, it seems, can compare to Joe 1. The first Cowboy Joe came from the Farthing Ranch, about 45 miles north of Cheyenne.
Our first ponies were imported from the Shetland Islands, and they came out with the family when the family came out here in 1903.
That's Carol Farthing, who married into the ranching family in 1978. She flipped through photos of the Joes, who've all come from the Farthing Ranch, at a restaurant in Cheyenne.
This first picture was when they first gave them, and this is my husband's grandfather and his grandmother, and playing with the pony there. At one time, we had over 1,000 ponies, largest breeder in the United States of ponies.
Deborah Amend, superintendent of the Wyoming Territorial Prison State Historic Site in Laramie, says the pony was given to the university in 1950.
He was a brown and white Shetland pony, and he was found nearly starved to death next to his dead mother in a large pasture in southern Wyoming. During his recovery, the family decided, because of his coloring, because he was brown and white, and his perseverance, made him appropriate mascot for the University of Wyoming football team.
Amen says that since 1950, Cowboy Joe, in his various iterations, has been the perfect mascot.
Some people don't understand it. Why would you have a little Shetland pony? It's not very powerful. When you say the Mustangs or you say the Broncos, that has a little, but when you say Shetland pony, you know, you think of a little tiny, you know, little toy thing. And I just think his bloodlines, his tenacity, his disposition, his spirit, all wrapped up in this amazing little body, I think it just is a great representative.
Back at Tailgate Park, Dana Eberhardt agrees.
I think he's a fantastic mascot, and I think he's the perfect pony mascot because all ponies are naughty. Everything about Laramie and Wyoming is kind of rebellious.
Farthing says ponies get this reputation because they're so much smarter than horses. But the incoming Joe is more tranquil than outgoing Joe. While the handlers like this about him, Eberhard would prefer more mischief.
I just met him for the first time this year, and they said he was really calm, so maybe he has to learn some more rebellious behavior. I don't know.
Cowboy Joe 5 will officially take over mid-season. So when the Pokes score a touchdown, fans will get to see what their new mascot is really made of. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
And we wrap up today's program with a poem by Laramie poet Kristen Gunther. It's called Belay.
The chlorophyll-starved canyon trees stripped themselves in the wind as I clung, fingers and jammed toes, to the limestone, feeling the disappearance of the sun, the cool drop of air. Those minutes shivered, slow, parallels calculated against rock, where, as in your hands, the rope blazed unreal yellow. I know how light it felt as you held it. I half know the knots that connected us at the hips. I know that in a later coming night, the brights would catch quick a great gray owl standing roadside, then drop back its shroud, to which it belonged, until you turned the car to show me, and we watched the wings shear at the edge of the light. I'm Kristen Gunther.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to contribute an essay or a poem to our program, or a story or an interview idea, you may pitch it through our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Tara Orr is our web editor. If you want to hear our entire show again or link to a particular segment, go to that same website and click on Open Spaces. We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page, and all of our reporters may be found on Twitter. You can follow me under the name Butter Bob. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.